This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Outrageous incidents of racism grab our attention. They are condemned. But what about incidents that aren't so egregious as to make headlines? Social anthropologist Annie Barnes joins us this afternoon to consider that question. Barnes is the author of Everyday Racism, a book for all Americans. For the book, Barnes solicited the stories of some 150 black college students from middle-class backgrounds. The students ranged in age from 18 to 40. Listeners, I hope you'll join the discussion with your questions and comments. Perhaps you have a story to share. Join us with a telephone call. Our number in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Annie Barnes is Professor Emerita of Sociology and Anthropology at Norfolk State University. She earned her doctorate from the University of Virginia, Charlottesville. Before teaching at the college level, she was a high school teacher. She taught American history and government. She is the author of several books, including The Black Middle Class Family, Black Woman, A Sociological Study of Work, Home, and Community, and Single Parents in Black America. Everyday Racism, A Book for All Americans, is published by Source Books, Incorporated of Naperville. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Barnes, welcome. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much, Celeste.
What prompted you to begin a study of racism experienced by middle-class college students?
I recognized that middle-class college students have the same experiences that adult middle-class blacks have, as well as poor middle-class blacks have. And therefore, if I were to use a black middle-class population, college population, I would be able to talk about racism as it exists in the American society. Now, I really wrote this book for many reasons. One is that I'm a social anthropologist, and social anthropology was born along with physical anthropology in the 19th century. And one of the things that we focused on was racism. And therefore, I have read so much that I could find on racism that had been written by social anthropologists. And then I read what psychologists and sociologists had written, and I wasn't pleased. I wanted the victims to speak for themselves. And as a result, I found that racism hurts the hearts and minds of little children, of young adults, and of older adults. And I wanted a population that was virgin, that didn't know much of anything about segregation, so that they wouldn't get the two twisted and intertwined. And so, therefore, we just have four or five people who know anything about segregation. And then I wanted to bring the races together. Celeste, I just believe that blacks and whites can live in this American society and respect each other and make our society a more beautiful society. And that's what I was aiming for.
Yeah. In the book, you say we're on a shared journey.
That's right. And that's why at the end of each chapter, I decided to write what whites can do and what whites can do to end the worst social scourge in the American society. I do not believe that it should be done only by whites. They must take the lead. But I also believe that there is a great deal that blacks can do to help overcome the scourge of American racism.
Yeah. The book now has been out for a little while, about a year and a half, if I'm correct. And I'm wondering, are people using this book as a tool to begin talking about race?
Yes, it's interesting. I was in San Francisco. When I say I was on the radio in San Francisco last Sunday, and there was a recall for me to come back this Sunday because they didn't get enough of it. It's just amazing. This year has been a more popular year than even the first year, and so we are finding that the book is just so popular all over the country, and people are so interested. They line up to talk with me, and one reason I will be on be back in San Francisco in terms of being on the show is that the callers were concerned that they didn't have enough time to ask questions, and so the book is so popular at this moment, and we are very happy, and of course Sourcebooks is too as well.
I wonder if part of the problem is that it's difficult to get this conversation going. It's difficult to talk about this problem.
No, I talk about it as though it was any other topic. I don't get hyper. In other words, my aim is to end racism or to lessen racism because I truly believe that whites think enough of themselves not to do racism. You know, Celeste, the truth about it is that parents who sit and talk about blacks in the presence of their little 2- and 3-year-olders, for example, and or they go out and they mistreat them or twist their eyes or mouths in against blacks, they are teaching their children racism. They are not allowing their children to grow up with healthy minds. I don't care whether you are black or white. If one is racist, he or she is not healthy, or at least doesn't have a healthy mind. And so I believe that as we continue to talk across America, and fortunately hosts have allowed me to talk from Hawaii to Toronto to Florida and all in between this year, and I believe that whites are going to recognize the fact, look, I don't want to teach my little child racism. I want my child to grow up with a healthy mind and decide for herself or himself at age 18 or later whether he or she wants to be a racist. And I think that whites think that much of themselves, and I know that all whites are not racist. The majority are, but the minority are not. And since that's the case, I have all kinds of hopes. And then I talk to black people. I say, you know, across the country, I say, you know, I call it the path of virtue. There is something that you must do in order to stop this scourge. And those things include, for example, high character. We must stop having babies out of wedlock. We must have high morality, a great work ethic whereby we work for intrinsic value, for the value of turning out a product or whatever we are doing, and enjoying seeing what we have done. And then the last thing that I really advise them, I'm summarizing all of those things that I have there in the book, but the last thing I suggest to them is that they not have rancor or anger toward whites and that they love whites. And when whites do racism, I ask them to wait until, for example, if a woman is shopping in a dress store, and the salesperson does racism, do not yell or scream. Instead, wait until her support system has gone, all the white shoppers. Also, wait until your support system has gone, all the black shoppers, and then walk up to that salesperson and say, you know, you really did hurt me by doing thus and so, and my heart really hurts, and I don't believe you want to do that, and you don't look like the kind of person who wants to hurt hearts and minds. And when you see people who look like me, my color, and me, will you kindly treat us nicely, and we're going to treat you nicely. And I say that all over America, and I truly believe that if we have this kind of confrontation, which is so loving and kind, that whites will say, hey, look, I'm not going to do racism because they're going to confront me. And when they confront me, they confront me so lovingly until I can't say anything back.
Have you had that experience? Have you taken someone aside and say, look, you've hurt me?
Yes. In fact, I just did it this week. Yes, indeed. I was scheduled to chair a program and to be on a presidential panel because I've been president of this organization, which is predominantly white, and so they changed the order of my program, and I knew my program was correct. Rather than to yell and scream about it, I emailed my friend, and because we've known each other 20 years, and I said, you know, real and truly, my program is not organized, and I'm not very happy, and I would like for you to reorganize my program. And I went on like that in the email, and then I got an email back, and surely enough, it's going to be changed. It works every time. Not every time, but most of the time, Celeste.
Let's talk about the people that you interviewed and for this study, and that their stories are in the book, Everyday Racism. How did you collect these stories? How were the students selected for the study?
We used what is called a convenience sample. I'm saying convenience. That's in the literature. And that means that you interview people whom you know. We wanted to make certain that we obtain the truth, and when I say we, I'm talking about students in my social science research skills seminar and myself. We went out and interviewed students whom I had taught, and it just so happened, of course, a lot of students come, well, they still do, and they came then to Norfolk State University from various parts of the country, and we recognized, look, you know, we really got a national sample here. And the first question we asked them, have you experienced racism? We did not want to bias this study in any way by saying, tell us your most racist experiences. No, we said, have you ever experienced racism? And they said, yes, we have experienced racism. Then we asked, will you please tell us your three worst experiences? And, of course, they wanted to spill on and on and on, but we took the worst three, and I have enough data left to write another book that would be somewhat the same but different.
Yeah.
Yes, And, of course, what I found, what we found is just appalling. There was a little 3-year-old girl whose name is Nina who took her Barbie doll to preschool, and she was attending an all-white preschool. And so she got up to give her Barbie to do show and tell, and the white little ones had done the same thing. And so after she finished, the student said, yuck, she's ugly. That's not Barbie. Nina was so hurt. Now, that occurred when she was a little girl, 3 years old. Now she's a college student, and she has never forgotten. It is so clear in her mind. So when racism occurs, it never seems to go away in the child's mind, even as he or she grows up. And Nina wanted to grow up and be like Barbie. She thought she was such pretty color and everything, and she said that she never played with Barbie again. So what we are finding is that little white children can do adult white racism. Mm. That's why I am so optimistic that whites are going to stop this trend and let their children grow up healthy and not do racism, adult racism as little children, nor children's racism.
Yeah. The impacts are immediate and long-term. I'm thinking here of the little boy in the book who didn't visit his grandparents as often as he wanted to because some bullies living in the neighborhood harassed him.
Yes, in fact, his grandparents had given him this beautiful bicycle, and he liked to eat ice cream in cold weather. And unfortunately, he went to get a cone of ice cream, and while in the store, white boys about his age liked his bicycle, and so he was able to wrestle it away from them, but eventually they took it from him and rode away, and he never saw his bicycle again, and he stopped going to see his grandparents for some time, and that was their pride and joy. They really did enjoy him visiting. So that's a situation of racism whereby it not only hurt the little boy, but it also hurt grandparents. And I think most grandparents like their grandchildren. I love them.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, I would like to see little children be like James and Forbes. James is black and Forbes is white. And the two of these kids had grown up since they were just little children playing in the yard on the lawn. And so they are still friends. And so one day, so I asked James, I said, James, what and how did you keep your friendship with Forbes so long? He said, we never let anything fester. We always talked it out. And I think that is a great thing for Americans, blacks and whites. If we have a problem, talk. They didn't argue it out. He said they talked it out. And talking also means to have the right tone of voice and do it kindly, and we can resolve our problems. And then I just must tell you this story. Donald and Shepard were 8 year olders when they started out, and they are still friends even though they're in college. And I asked Donald about him and Shepard, and Shepard is white and he's black. And Donald said, well, Shepard never said anything about color. Color never seemed to matter to him, even now. And wouldn't it be wonderful if adults could just take the lead from these two little children as they were then, 8 years of age, on up through college, and not let color make any difference, and we would have an entirely different society.
We've got a couple of callers waiting to talk with us. Annie Barnes is our guest this afternoon. She's Professor Emerita of Sociology and Anthropology at Norfolk State University. We're talking with her this afternoon about her book, Everyday Racism, A Book for All Americans. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to talk with us, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with our first caller this afternoon on the toll free line in Chicago. Hi.
Hello.
Hello there.
Hello.
Hello. Yes, yes. I'm a retired teacher. I was a history major, and I eventually became a language teacher. I've traveled all over the world, and I just want to say this. Conflict between mankind has to do with survival, economics. If a person is comfortable economically, generally he has no need to destroy someone else. I don't want the audience to think that the black middle class feels like this lady. If somebody is unkind to you, that you have no rancor against that person. I do. I do. And I don't feel the need to prove to white Americans that I'm clean or moral, or if I do anything good, it's because I respect myself. It's not because I want to prove to white America that I'm a wonderful person. God bless her. She's a good person. But please don't think that every educated middle-class person feels that they have to toady up to white America to prove that they're somebody. Anything that I do good is because I respect myself and my own family.
May I respond?
Certainly.
I did not say that. I did not say that at all. I did not say that you do that to impress Americans. When I talked about the work ethics, I was doing that. I was talking about that for themselves, and so I have not said anything to impress Americans, white Americans, because that's not the problem. It's respect between the two groups of people. And let me explain. Economics is not it. William Julius Wilson has been putting out that information for several years. He indicates that economics or social class is more important than color. I'm a social anthropologist, and I would ask the lady to do some reading around the world, and she will find in every society where there is racism, the people have these resources. They have the resources of the country. They have the money. They have the authority, and they have the power. That does. I don't care what country.
And they want to keep
and,
the power.
And even Vernon Jordan and I had an experience recently, and he experienced racism. And I don't think Vernon Jordan is poor, and nor do I. I don't know whether he's rich or not, but I know he isn't poor. And so, which means economics. Whites do not. Whites are not concerned about your economic situation. They may give you a little more respect, but if your skin is black, when I say black, any shade of black, you're going to experience racism if you are not, if you don't handle it in a certain way.
Does a caller want to follow up?
Oh, yeah. When I say economics, I'm saying that if you go to Ireland and the English are in power and they have all of the good jobs, they want to keep them. They don't want them to go to the Catholics. If you go to Spain, where the gypsies have not been allowed to participate in any meaningful way economically, they want to make sure that the gypsies never do, so that all the good things will stay with the people that are in power and that have them. It is economics. If people are very, very, very wealthy and very, very, very comfortable, they want to keep that, and anything that threatens them not controlling what they have and amassing more, if they can destroy it, they will destroy it. That's
the lady
about it.
Has just supported me, except the fact she didn't include authority. You can have economics, for example, she can have several million dollars, but if she doesn't have any authority, she's still going to experience racism.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Annie Barnes is our guest this afternoon. I want to thank the caller from Chicago for talking with us this afternoon and invite others to join us with questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. We had a caller call in with this question. They couldn't stay on the line. The question is this for you, Professor. How would you address the issues of reverse racism by blacks on whites? How can empathetic whites deal with hatred by blacks?
That's a great question. Blacks cannot do racism against whites. Blacks do racism against each other. Whites do racism against each other and against blacks. The only people who can, again, do racism are the people who control the society. For example, if I'm your boss in on this job, and you call me, let's say I'm white, and you call me a cracker, I can fire you. I am the one who has the power. And so really and truly, when blacks say ugly things, they do. And they act ugly at times, and why is because something has occurred against them, against their parents, or against friends, or someone whom they didn't even know. And so so what they have to do is just simply recognize the fact that blacks are reacting. We have learned almost everything we know from whites. And so, therefore, what looks like racism is a form or is racism, but it's reaction racism toward whites. Blacks do very little of that. You find very few examples in this country of blacks spitting on whites. In my book, you find that this is the case. Not only that, whites will throw buckets of feces. That's in the book. These children were not tainted by segregation, and they are telling what exactly happened to them. We'll throw buckets of feces on them, And so, therefore, you've just got to have the power, and you've got to have the authority, and blacks are not doing racism against whites. In fact, if you notice, blacks do not commit mass murder. Blacks do rarely kill whites. Blacks are very careful about that. You can just take those two examples and recognize the fact that they really do not hurt whites at all. They hurt themselves. Now, there's plenty of black racism against each other, but they react to racism against whites.
Annie Barnes, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Let's talk about racism in schools, because I think this is a very important issue that you raised. That there's a good-sized chapter in the book about racism in schools. from the earliest years in school all the way up through graduate school in college. And I've got to tell you that the stories involving school teachers being racist, I found particularly hurtful. And you say, you point out that, you know, some of these incidents can lead kids to withdraw and to drop out.
Oh, they do. And not only that, they don't perform as well, because when students, for example, the racism that they usually experience includes a number of things. For example, lack of eye contact, lack of placing a beautiful poster that's more beautiful than one made by a white student in the corner rather than in a vivid spot, lack of getting a pat on the back, lack of smiling at the student, lack of saying, oh, Jane, if it's black, made A, just like you said that Susie made A who is white. All right, now all of those things hurt black students so badly, and also blacks have to sit in the back of some students' rooms, and especially if they make A's, in this book, it's very clear, the students had that experience. All right, now, and then also they have to sit behind certain colors for reading. They can't sit with the white students. They have to sit with the Hispanic students. All right, so then what occurs is that black students will get so disgusted, and especially black males, and that's a hurtful thing. Black males will actually drop out of school. I have done a book on retention of African-American males in high school, and when I went into these various communities, they just told, and especially poor communities, they told me they just could not take that racism from them. They weren't as brave as Morrison was from New York. If you remember Morrison, the teacher wouldn't recognize him. He was a great math student, and he would raise his hand, and she would never recognize him. So one day he stood up, and he said, "Ma'am, do you like black people?" Mm-hmm. And from that day on, Morrison was always recognized. But you see, that doesn't always happen. And then another thing that happens to our young people, to young black people, is that they cannot learn as well because they are hurt by something that has occurred. And then they've got to deal with that in their minds. And then they've got to remember the lesson that is being taught. So when you put the two together, then the whites only have to deal with the lessons. Then you have an unequal situation there.
Yeah. There's a story in the book that involves, well, there are many stories in the book that involve layers and layers of racism. And there's a story that I want to share. This involves Lester, who was a talented young
drum major.
Yes. And may I read this?
Yes.
Okay, because I want to offer it to folks just to just so that they can pick out all the ways that this is wrong.
Yes.
Okay. Lester, 21, describes a vivid experience of discrimination in his high school. "I was a rising junior who had developed a great appreciation for music. I'd begun writing and directing music for my high school and jazz bands. Many of my friends' parents and directors from other local high schools congratulated me. I decided to audition for drum major. Conflict developed because the white female director at my school had a philosophy that would not allow me to head the all-white band. My high school in Churchland, Virginia, had never had a black drum major. It resulted from the paranoid notion that a black drum major would cause the band to fade to black. I found out that the director accepted this traditional concept. When I auditioned, I received the highest score, but only received a second fiddle position. I did behind-the-scenes work, teaching and writing music with no recognition. The first time that I was denied the position of drum major, I felt betrayed. I had trusted my director as a friend and many of the band parents. For me, love had no color. When I didn't make the audition, at first I felt there was something that I hadn't done. What I learned was that it was because of my skin color. I realized that my dreams would be a mystery to whites, meaning that whites would not understand my success. They only think of white success. That's not right. I decided to achieve on my own for my people. My people to me means all people who despise and are against all forms of racism. My band director tried to explain her reason by saying that the Band Parents Association was not, quote, ready for a black drum major. She said that the school had a traditional style, and if I were to become drum major, the school would lose respect. The following year, I decided to try out again. This time, I was told that I had to get permission from the principal, assistant principal, and a few band parents. No one had ever done that before. I assumed someone was trying to get someone else to deny me the opportunity to break a racial tradition. Well, I obtained the various permissions, but not without strife. Since it had not been done before, the principals and others were concerned about the process. Furthermore, they were surprised that I didn't get the position the first time I tried out for it. They knew I deserved it. They have a stereotypical opinion that blacks are musically inclined that had long been an area accepted by whites. The higher-ups were surprised that a teacher wouldn't let a black excel in music. Basically, the judges scored us from 1 to 10 in the various categories they made up, like writing music, directing music, teaching music, and marching techniques. Mind you, I had done all those things before I ever auditioned. During my interview, I explained to the judges what had happened the year before and hinted that I knew I had won this time and would drop band if I didn't win without a legitimate reason. I won. At first, I was paranoid, but when my band showed they had confidence in me, that was all I needed. I was there for them writing and teaching music. They marched until they sweated blood for me, and together we won band competitions. Under my leadership, the band won competitions that had never won before. The band was appreciated by blacks and even more by whites. More blacks joined the band and more white students had fun with the music. Black students and white students should be given an equal chance to excel. That would benefit teachers, schools, and communities. When I became drum major, my director advised me to drop algebra and chemistry and take music classes to free up more time to help her. She went to the office, changed my classes, and said it was for my benefit. I needed those classes for college. Consequently, I changed them back with a smile and told her, "No hard feelings, but I would rather learn something." You know, if I was this young man, I would have plenty of hard feelings.
Yes, yes, and Lester did. It was a very difficult experience for him. However, he was pleased to find that the students stayed by him and worked with him and proved to the community as well as to the teacher that indeed letting a black person become the leader does not in any way jeopardize anything.
No. But, you know, you shouldn't have to be like Lester.
No, you shouldn't.
It's like that caller, that first caller that we had said, you know, this is above and beyond, you know.
But Lester's skin is still, even though he was middle class and very talented, his skin was still black, and that's the whole problem. That is the problem. If we can do like the two young boys, forget about the color of skin, we would not have this kind of situation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the suggestions you make in the book is for families to talk about the issue routinely so that
yes.
children are not afraid of racism.
Yes, yes. In fact, when I did my Black Middle Class Family book, one of the things that I learned about families in Atlanta, Georgia, middle class families, is that they always had dinner together. If a child had late band rehearsal or whatever, dinner was delayed because that was the most important time of day, and they sat at the table, and the first people to speak were the children, and they always asked the children, "How did your day go?" And the children were taught to always tell their problems, and the parents then would tell them how to handle. The whole family would join in and decide how that kind of problem should be handled next time. And then the mother, who worked, also would tell her problems. And then dad was the last person to tell his problems. And so that worked to an extent. However, they found that racism is so creative, or people who do racism do such creative racism, until you can never be prepared for it. However, it did give them some kind of buffer so that they could deal with it better than if they had never had that good conversation at home.
Let's talk with some listeners. We're going to go to a caller on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hello. Hi.
Good afternoon.
Yes, I'm wondering if you've heard about the paperback book, Sugar and the Criminal Mind.
Yes, yes.
Have you heard that about that paperback
book? I have not read it, but I know the title.
And that's that was put out in the 1970s by Prevention Magazine.
I'm going to jump in here because the caller is way off topic.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so let's go to another listener on line two in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
It must be really exhausting for blacks to have to continually confront racism. It must take a lot of energy to stand up to it. And I think that we all need to call it when we see it and or try to be a bridge and an advocate. As an example, I was standing in line at a hotel waiting to have breakfast, and standing behind me was a couple, and it was a mixed-race couple, and I was facing away from the restaurant talking to them when one of the staff from the restaurant came by to get names for the reservation list. And she talked to me first because I was first in line, and then she skipped over the couple, and my interpretation was that she thought we were together. His interpretation, he was black, was that she skipped over him because he was black, mm-hmm. and said to me, blacks are invisible. He was very bitter about it, and we called her back, and he got his name on the list. And then later on, I saw her in the restaurant, and I spoke to her, and I said, do you realize that that man felt that you skipped over him on purpose and that it was because he was black? And she was mortified, and she said, I would never do that. In fact, I'm married to a black man, and I'll go talk to him right away. I'm so sorry this happened. And so she went and talked to him, and afterwards he came over and spoke to me, and I was just pleased to have done one small thing. Because even though she did not mean to be racist, and she probably wasn't, and there was probably a reason because of our way we were arranged, why she did what she did, he still felt the blow, even though it wasn't meant. And so it was worth taking the energy to speak to this young waitstaff person. And we don't always have the energy to do it, but we have to try and do it more to decrease the hurt and raise awareness.
Thank you so much, and I hope all white Americans will do just what you have done. It will make a difference.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We've got about 7-8 minutes left in this portion of the program. Let me reintroduce our guest. Annie Barnes is Professor Emerita of Sociology and Anthropology at Norfolk State University. She's the author of several books. The one we're talking about today is Everyday Racism, A Book for All Americans. It's published by Source Books Incorporated of Naperville. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments in Champaign-Urbana. Our number 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Barnes, do you have any other concrete suggestions for what we might do, blacks and whites?
Yes, yes. I mentioned a few that blacks can use, and I would also like to mention a few that whites can use. For example, there was a great English anthropologist by the name of Ashley Montague who once said that if you have not grown up as a warm and loving individual, then begin practicing. So the first thing that I would recommend is that all adults and young adults begin practicing undoing racism in their own personal lives. And if they do that, then the group will just grow in terms of the number of people who are not racist. Secondly, I would suggest that parents be very careful and stop doing racism for the sake of their children, if not for their own sake, and they will be happier. thirdly, I would suggest to Weiss that they fill in that spot. There is a reason why people do racism. If it's a black person, there is a reason. That person is lacking something. If a white person does racism, that person, too, is lacking something. Rather than do racism and hurt people's hearts and minds, it would be easier, actually, to do something kind rather than to do otherwise. And then in terms of education, I think that universities and colleges should put more emphasis on multicultural education in terms of people to people. They talk about different cultures, but that's not enough. They need to talk about how to treat people, get down to the grassroots of the situation, because our children learn so much in schools. And if we can transmit this information from one grade level to another, we're going to have a better America in terms of education. And then another thing I would suggest for whites, it comes to the stores. Blacks have such burden on them when they try to spend their hard-earned money. That's from Neiman Marcus right on down to almost Kmart. And what occurs is there are two things. One is that white salespersons will not recognize the presence of a black, or they will follow that person and make the person uncomfortable. Therefore, the person can't browse, touch things, and enjoy the shopping experience. And then, on the other hand, the second point is that there's a vocabulary in all of the stores. And really and truly, that vocabulary includes such things as, we don't take food stamps. Now, mind you, nobody's ever said anything, never asked any of these questions. We don't take food stamps. We do not have a layaway plan. If you have a charge card, I have to run a check on it. I told you people that we don't take we don't take food stamps. And so there is this vocabulary. Oh, and then the black people have to say, I'm next. And then when they go to the case to buy, say, a purse, the purses may range from, let's say, $50 to $500. They always start at the bottom of the range. Not always. We know there are exceptions to everything I'm saying, but generally they start at the bottom of the range, and the poor and the middle class black person with enough money, more than enough money to buy a great purse, has to keep saying, "May I see that one? Oh, that one is pretty." Or, "Oh, do you mind taking that one out?" And by the time you get through, you have not enjoyed spending your money because it's been a hard experience to buy what you want. On the other hand, if you just walk around and watch and wait for a white person to go to that counter, usually, not always, they will start, it depends also on their interpretation of the white person, they will start at the top of the merchandise and work down, and it's such a beautiful experience because the white person can say, I'd like for you to move down, and I really would like a pocketbook, a purse here, and rather than keep asking for the purses. So there needs to be education in all institutions, whether it's a store, whether it's the police department, whether it's schools. They need to bring in people who will teach them how to detonate the scourge of racism. And if they have an education, and people need to be educated, and corporations, small stores, large stores, schools, police departments should not wait one moment. They should call in people and help get these departments straight. And also, police chiefs should be appointed who are truly police chiefs, who will do the right thing, because normally the people in an institution follow the leader. Mm-hmm.
That's where we'll have to leave it. We're out of time. Thank you for talking with us this afternoon.
Celeste, thank you so much, and you are perfectly welcome. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Annie Barnes has been our guest this afternoon. She's Professor Emerita of Sociology and Anthropology at Norfolk State University. She's the author of Everyday Racism, a book for all Americans.